Side 10. Man of Two Worlds by Frank Herbert and Brian Herbert. Continuing on page 384. Wide-eyed, Woon stared at Lutt as though seeing a stranger. When the senator spoke, it was in a low, growling voice.
Any idea what the French want?
Sure. They want my spiral communicators and my spaceship. They'll trade Mother for those little concessions.
Give them what they want.
If they give me what I want.
I've cut a few corners in my life, Woon said. But you make me look like a Sunday school teacher by comparison.
He grabbed both arms of his chair and levered himself to his feet.
I'll talk to this Mrs. Eby, and I believe I'd better see your Raj dude.
You'll do that. And ask his advice. Lutt pictured his voice in a parody of Woon's booming tones.
I hear dude gives great fucking advice.
I wish Wempley the Voyager had lived. I'd like to send him searching for the bottom of the Sea of All Things. Mutterings of Habiba. I am not the Habiba of old, nor will I ever be again. The thought drifted through Habiba's mind and was gone. She stared out of her cupola at the gray morning shadows of her beloved Dreener. Amplified vision revealed a crowd of her most responsible taxables lurching along a pathway near the horizon, all obviously far gone on Bazeel. She did not have the heart to reprimand them, nor prohibit the drug. It was being grown quite openly now in many homes. Jongleur had just departed after delivering an account of Denny Ra's captivity.
Mowgli says Denny Ra may be a latent, Jongleur said.
Latents, capable of wildly unpredictable imaging, were a periodic problem among dreams, but they had always been managed with soother therapy. It did not seem possible in the present circumstances that they could get a soother to Denny Ra. Of late, Habiba had entertained the suspicion that Wempley might have been a latent. That would explain many things, but the suspicion came far too late. We will waste no more of our people on that accursed planet, Habiba ordered.
Does that mean you will not send the Erasure ship?
Jongleur quavered.
It means only what I say it means.
Jongleur, recoiling as a wave of Habiba's rage scent swept over him, fled into the morning without her dismissal.
Send Mowgli, she bellowed after him.
Mowgli appeared presently, but stood at the base of the cupola's spiral ramp. Did he think distance protected him from her probing stare?
If I ordered an immediate thought-con, what would I learn from you? She asked.
Mowgli, with no time to image a memory block, looked around him in fear and trembling. No other elites shared the cupola. He had never heard of a thought-con with a single elite. Was that possible?
I know what I would find, Habiba said.
Did my imaged memory block fail?
I have never needed a thought-con to read the hearts of my taxables, Habiba said. You have conspired against me, Mowgli.
Blessed Habiba, I have always acted only for the good of Dreener.
Don't give me that blessed Habiba crap. You're the most prideful Dreen I've ever known. You planned from the first to be the captain of that Erasure ship. Mowgli drew himself up stiffly on all four legs.
I am willing to sacrifice myself for the good of my people.
They are not your people.
And what do you know about the good of Dreendom? You have infected us all with an illness for which there may be no cure.
Habiba!
Erase Earth, and the consequences will be catastrophic, she said. The accursed planet and its life forms are woven all through our legends and lore. Before I put a ban on it, Earth was our most frequently visited storyteller scene.
The more reason to remove it, Habiba.
You don't listen to me. Without Earth, dream abilities will be crippled. Storytellers will fear the consequences of every image. Am I creating another Earth? They will ask. And our universe will explode in a burst of storyteller frustration.
But the flaw of Earth is known to us. Free will and its evolution have...
Pride, that is the flaw. The same pride that drives you, Mowgli, drove Wimpley to that insane creation.
Surely, Habiba, this cannot be as bad as...
Your pride drives you now to question even me, Habiba accused. I have a cure for that, Mowgli.
We will hold a ThoughtCon immediately. It will place you on trial.
You are the shame of dreamdom. Your evil will be known to all. Mowgli's horned tool nose quivered. Abruptly he lurched into motion and began climbing the ramp. Habiba watched him approach, curious at his behavior. She had not asked him to come closer. What was he doing? 2 paces below Habiba, Mowgli paused. The odor of his rage was unmistakable. She saw his eyes swivel inward for imaging. A length of the ramp vanished to supply imaging material, and a long staff appeared in his hands. When his eyes swiveled outward, he lunged at her with the staff. A spear. She recognized it from stories of earther violence. The smell of anesthetic poison on the blade chilled her. Mowgli intended murder. Habiba jerked aside as the spear gashed her left arm. She reacted in pain and dismay. I need a defensive weapon. From the depths of her survival instincts and with superior imaging, she sealed her wound and created a weapon. A tommy gun materialized in her hands as Mowgli drew back for another thrust. Without conscious volition, Habiba squeezed the trigger. A chattering roar deafened her as bullets drew a line of yellow holes across Mowgli's chest. The impacts threw him off the ramp and he fell far down to the floor with a sodden thump. Feeling coldly remote, she leaned over to stare down at him. Was he conscious? Could he image repairs to his damaged flesh? But the fall had rendered him unconscious. She saw his yellow blood oozing onto the floor. He lay there, unmoving, as life drained from him. Habiba felt the moment of Mowgli's death, and a dreadful stillness permeated her, draining her maternal spirit. The skin tightened across her forehead, removing storyteller wrinkles. She looked down at the tommy gun in her hands and grinded it out of existence with a shudder of revulsion. What have I done? She tried to rationalize the awful occurrence. Mowgli would have killed me. I defended myself for the good of all dreams. That carried the suspicious ring of Mowgli's arguments. Am I the most prideful dream? It was a shattering thought. Could Mowgli have been right about Earth? No. Her arguments about the consequences had skirted something far deeper in her awareness. Somewhere within her lay the certainty that Dreener would end if they erased her. Premeditated annihilation of all that life? I cannot bring myself to order it. But I killed Mowgli. Slowly, she descended the ramp and stood over Mowgli's body. It looked pitiful. A wave of anguish swept through her. She picked up the body, pausing to grind away the evidences of disaster on the floor. Once again, deadly stillness drained her. The ancient familiarity of the feeling set her trembling. My taxables must not learn what I have done. Carrying Mowgli, she descended a private passage to the red mud-brick dwelling, her first home on Dreener. There she imaged a deep hole in the floor and buried Mowgli. When the floor was restored, she squatted and contemplated her problem. I am but one person. I cannot hold all creation together by myself. But what is the difference between defending myself from Mugley and defending Dreamdom by erasing Earth? Consequences. The consequences of defensive actions always had to be weighed. Mugley was gone, and his absence certainly would involve her in elaborately fanciful storytelling fabrications. But am I not the supreme storyteller? This thought vibrated an odd chord of memory deep within her. She could not quite place it, but someone once had called her that.
You are the supreme storyteller. The task is yours.
She could almost hear the voice. It was someone she could not identify. Someone who no longer existed. How could there be someone such as that? Did she not know every dream? She squatted there, trembling with the things hidden in her, unaware for several heartbeats that Jongleur had returned, and stood in the doorway from the lower hall.
Habiba, he ventured, what was that loud noise? Many heard it, but
I did not summon you, she said.
Love brings me, Habiba. What is wrong?
Thus the fabrication begins, she thought, and said,
I have had to send Mugley on a difficult mission. Mugley? I did not see him leave. What mission, Habiba? Not the Erasure ship.
A mission even more difficult than that, she said.
Medical records available to us show Candidate Hansen has grown several centimeters taller and gained at least 7 kilos of weight in the past few months. How does he explain this? Does he suffer a dangerous hormone imbalance? The public deserves a full clarification of this oddity. An opposition news release.
Ladies and gentlemen, in 2 days we will elect the next President of the United States.
The announcer, Utley Trask, a familiar, benign, gray-haired figure chosen especially for this moment, paused and smiled as cheers, whistles, and shouts erupted from the crowd packing the floor of the convention hall below him. Luck, seated to Trask's left with Eola Van Dyke Hansen at his side, thought they had done pretty well filling the hall at 9 a.m. He glanced at Eola, seeing the glitter of her new wedding ring. She produced her finishing school smile for the cheering people. Although he had purposely avoided subduing Ryle with Basil, Lutt felt a surge of belligerence.
Eola for show, Nini for bed.
No response yet from the French, but he felt confident. The Legion still kept the Phoenicia story under wraps.
A sure sign they won't refuse my demands.
Utley Trask raised both hands to restrain the crowd. The calls and cheering slowly subsided. Lutt glanced into the platform wings to his right. A wheeled cage containing Denny Ra in human guise waited there.
In a few minutes we cinch the election, Lutt thought. Fear and the promise of jobs will do the trick. I'll win by a landslide. The moment has come to show you why Lutt Hansen, Jr. is the only man for this most sensitive position in our universe, Trask said. But first, one of the most pleasant moments of my life.
He grinned at Eola, then returned his attention to the crowd.
A wonderful surprise, folks. Early this morning, in a quiet ceremony at his home, Lutt Hansen, Jr. and Eola Van Dyke were joined in the holy bonds of matrimony.
A deafening roar boomed through the hall. Calls and shouts continued for 5 minutes. When they subsided, the announcer grinned and waved at Lutt.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next President of the United States, Lutt Hansen, Jr.
Lutt took his position at the microphones, glancing at the ranks of cameras aimed down at him, at the crowd, then at the portable speech analyzer in the palm of his left hand. He aimed a practiced smile at Eola and swung it back toward the floor of the hall. Presently, he raised both arms. The uproar quieted quickly. They had been prepared for a momentous announcement. Stories leaked about a world-shaking revelation. Expectation could be seen in the uplifted faces. Even the media people sat poised behind the glass of their booths,
knowing he would not have built them up for anything but a big story. What was this alien menace, hinted at in stories being leaked from Hansen headquarters?
My friends, Lutz said, we all know the time has come for us to revitalize this great nation. My opponents have led us into a desperate situation. Food prices have doubled in the past year. Unemployment is on the rise.
He paused and assumed a grim expression before continuing to read the prepared speech projected onto the transparent screen in front of the lectern.
How can we be uncaring when so many Americans live dreary lives in shanty homes?
That was for the masses of voters Woon's people had registered in the Lowtowns.
Yes, he shouted. We need food for the poor. Yes, we need jobs for people my opponents ignore, people who want only to stand proud in the knowledge they support themselves.
Lutt slid the PSA into its wrist sheath and placed a hand along each side of the lectern. He gripped the wood until his knuckles went white, a gesture he had learned from Woon.
But there is something even more menacing my opponents have ignored, even though they are well aware of it.
He looked up at the ranked lenses. The opposition was out there, monitoring every word, every movement.
I face you today with dogged determination, with a deep conviction based on dedication, intelligence, and ethics. Those initials spell DIE. And we all will surely die if my message is ignored.
He gestured for the waiting Hansen guards and Zone Patrol troopers to wheel out Denny Ra's cage. The cage trundled onto the stage with a calculated squeaking of wheels. The crowd stirred. Strobe lights flared. Cameras turned toward this new development. Whispers sent a susurration through the hall.
Who the hell's he got in the cage?
Looks like a leftover John Wayne stand-in.
Shut up and listen.
The guards stopped the cage 2 paces to Lutz's right and stood there with weapons ready. Denny Ra clutched the bars and glared truculently at the crowd. Lutz pointed at the caged Dreen.
Creatures such as this walk among us, he shouted. You might never give one of them a second glance. They look just as human as any of us. But they are not. They are alien. They intend to destroy us.
On cue, Denny Ra's human guys slumped into a mound of protoplasm and reformed in Dreen shape. 2 6-fingered hands rattled the bars, rocking the cage back and forth. A concerted gasp lifted from the crowd. The guards pointed their weapon to the Dreen, and one of them said,
Stop that, or we shoot.
Denny Ra slouched back on all 4 feet.
Shoot if you must, you scum-gut swine, she bellowed. But you nesters are a-gonna get yours. You're on Dreenland. One day soon you'll have till sundown to get off.
Still pointing at Denny Ra, Lutz shouted,
Your so-called leaders have left us defenseless in the face of this menace. I am calling for an end to that head-in-the-sand stupidity. We must build weapons and warships for space. We must attack and destroy these aliens on their own ground.
Luck lowered his head and swept his gaze across the crowd.
My opponents whisper behind my back that I am making a secret accord with potential enemies, the French. That is a lie. Do any of you think the French Foreign Legion will fail to fight beside our brave Zone Patrol once this menace is seen?
A cheer roared through the hall and subsided in gasps. Luck glanced at Denny Ra. As rehearsed, the Dreen had shapeshifted into a cobra and threatened to slip through the bars. The guards prodded Denny Ra back into captivity.
All of Earth must rally behind us in the face of this threat, Lutz shouted. We must convert factories and build new ones. The technology to destroy these aliens is known. Yes, it is a product of my own invention. I am prepared for this terrible task. Are you?
The roaring, stamping response told Lutz all he needed to know. A glance at the PSA confirmed it. He had them. Fear of an alien threat meant jobs in a new weapons industry. All could see it. And his people had leaked enough stories about Lutz's war traveler. An invention from the fertile mind of Lutt Hansen, Jr.
If the French won't enter the act, okay, but only on my terms.
Ryle had heard and seen enough. His Earther lessons coalesced into a demand for action.
Lutt, baby,
Ryle intuited. Shut up, Train.
No way, Lutt, baby. What happens to the election if your zone patrol guards see you exposed as a dreen?
You wouldn't dare.
If I have to go to prison too, so be it, Lutt, baby.
Stop calling me that.
Calling you what?
Baby.
But I learned it from you. And this is showdown time, Lutt, baby. Even if I can't retake control of our body, which is an unresolved issue, I certainly can raise questions to which the ZP has answers. Got it?
You mean it?
Think about it. No Nini, no presidency, nothing but a prison for the creature who posed as Lutt Hansen, Jr. You'll be part of the alien menace you've been at such pains to announce.
What do you want, Ryle?
I told you I wouldn't permit you to attack Trina.
Okay, now attack.
But you don't mean it.
I promise.
And I see through your empty promise.
What do I have to do?
You already know. Turn over control of our body to me on my demand, and no more Bazeel unless I ask for it.
Never.
Never is an awful long time, Lutt. Especially if we're in a ZP prison.
Can we share control of my body?
Our body.
Okay, our body.
That's what I've proposed all along. And if you agree, you'd better remember I can read every thought in your head.
The convention hall clamor was diminishing. Lutt's shoulders slumped. The portable speech analyzer immediately prompted him. Straighten up, look firm and sincere. He obeyed. In his private thoughts, Ryle observed this and came to a determination.
I will rule this earther.
And now he knew how to do it. It was a basic truth he had come to recognize through observation of Lutt. Let a person desire something enough, and you can rule the person through that desire. Lutt wanted power. He lusted after it, more than he lusted after any woman.
Nishi must never be bound to this earther, Ryle thought. I will protect her.
In this position, the blade gun appears to be an ordinary short-bladed pocket knife. Give the handle a half turn, as shown, press the raised decoration, number 3 on the diagram, and the blade shoots where it is aimed, deadly within 8 meters. The BG's automatic rearm instantly puts another projectile in place for 7 more shots. Poison or anesthetic injector blades are available. Blades, sold in cartons of 24, and the knife handle are high-impact plastic. They will not trip a metal detector. A brochure privately circulated to officials. Nishi paced across a suite of the Madison Hotel in Washington, D.C., admiring the antique French decor and the sepia engravings of Napoleonic Paris. Even the VidCom was concealed in a graceful vase. Draperies hid the streets and muted the morning sunlight. She could almost imagine she had been moved back in time to those less frenetic days pictured on the walls. Whitey was a ball of yellow fur on an Empire chair, its thought-spying range defensively reduced because of many bad things here. So much evil in this nation's capital overwhelmed Whitey's native naivete, Nishi reasoned. Mrs. Eby was next door. Lorna and Lou Subiyama occupied connecting rooms in her prefect protector with legion guards in mufti at adjoining quarters beyond the Subiyamas. She glanced at her watch. Lutt should arrive in a few minutes. President Lutt Hansen, Jr. It was odd to think of him that way, but she had watched media coverage of his inauguration and acceptance speech, had seen him display a captive dream. And she knew the United States Capitol bustled with new activity, many nations seeking a share in the Human Defense League with its lucrative weapons contracts. Human Defense League. It was a clever label. Her prefect was here because of that organization. We must share the burden.
He won't share profits, Whitey had translated.
He want Nishi boss Lut president.
Is that why I'm here?
Nishi wondered.
Bait? A bargaining chip?
But the French had Phoenicia, and that still unannounced charge of an offense against the state. They could execute her.
Why does Lot insist I come here? He has a wife.
Lot president want lustful breeding Nishi, Whitey said. Lorna and Lou Subiyama slipped in the connecting door. Lou looked fearful, his gaze downcast. He kept glancing at Whitey as though afraid Nishi's pet would attack him.
Not here yet?
Lorna asked.
Jesus! A frigging president of the United States coming to you instead of you going to him. You got some hold on that bastard's balls, honey.
The prefect insisted we keep to the hotel,
Nishi said.
Here, we have our own security.
Prefect man make spy things, Whitey offered.
Those business suits on your legionnaires didn't fool that White House arranger one second,
Laura said.
But I was surprised he caved in so fast.
I have a diplomatic passport,
Nishi said.
Yeah, honey, but this is still the president. I'll bet he wants into your panties. Should we leave you two alone?
I have already explained my position,
Nishi said.
But a gal's got a right to change her mind, Lorna said. Let me know if we should hightail it out of here.
A soft rap sounded on the hall door. It opened to reveal Captain O'Hara in a Harris tweed suit.
Your guest is coming up the elevator, mademoiselle, he said. Secret service men are here, and we have cleared the hallway.
Very good, monsieur,
Nishi said.
Lou, go hold the door,
Lorna ordered. Lou scuttled to obey and took the door handle from O'Hara, who went out of view. His voice could be heard.
A man at each elevator. Be polite but firm.
Isn't it cute the way Lou does everything I want?
Lorna asked.
There was no time for an answer. An abrupt flurry of sounds in the hall signaled the arrival of the president.
Lut, accompanied by two Secret Service men, swept past Lou and stopped 3 paces from Nishi. He looked her up and down.
Everybody but Nishi out, Lut said.
But sir,
a Secret Service man protested. Lut hooked a thumb over his shoulder.
Out!
He glanced at the Subiyamas.
You too.
Have fun,
Lorna said. She took Lou's arm and left with the Secret Service men. When the door closed behind them, Lut asked,
How about this, Nini? President Hanson.
And how is your first lady?
Nishi asked.
Forget her, Nini. She's for show and to please mother.
You wish to discuss your mother's situation now?
Hell, Nini, didn't that fat French bastard clue you to what's going on?
I do not understand, Mr. President.
Come on, Nini. Take off your clothes and let's get with it.
He began unbuttoning his suit coat.
None of that,
she said, backing away from him.
Whitey, help me, Whitey.
Whitey, help.
Lut suddenly moaned and put both hands to his head.
Jesus, what's happening?
He staggered to his left.
You doing this, Ryle, you son of a bitch?
I will speak to Ryle,
Nishi said. As he had done fruitlessly several times in the past week, Ryle demanded control of their body. You made a solemn promise, Lut. And I know you meant it. If you go back on your word, I will carry out my threat.
To hell with you.
I see it all now,
Ryle said.
You have learned to play at being sincere. You really mean to attack Dreener.
Lut twisted his head and groaned.
You lying Dreen, son of a bitch.
I warned you I would not permit an attack on my people.
You're killing me,
Lut moaned.
Please stop.
It is not I who causes you pain,
Ryle offered.
It is that yellow creature on the chair.
It's you. Just when things are going great, you mess it up.
I assure you, it is the soother. I do not know how Nishi acquired it. They are reserved for latents and other aberrated types.
Lut staggered to an Empire couch and collapsed onto it.
Enough, Whitey,
Nishi ordered. Lut took a deep breath and slowly lowered his hands. Nishi saw the fight for transition to Ryle as a flickering of movement in face and eyes, the slight sagging of jaws, a brighter gleam in the eyes that faded in return.
Ryle remained on the couch.
I am happy to find you well, Nishi, he said. These are times to try one's soul.
Why has he brought me here?
She asked. Plutt tried to interfere and regain control. The shared face grimaced, lips moved, grunts issued from the mouth.
Whitey?
Nishi prompted. Once more, Lutt clutched his head.
Okay, okay!
Lutt gasped. She waited for Whitey to relax the pain, then...
Ryle?
Again, Ryle's voice issued from the familiar mouth.
He wishes only disgusting, lustful things with you, Nishi.
I thought so.
The French envoy said Lutt must make his own repellent way with you. Lutt was led to believe you agreed.
The prefect? He said nothing of this to me,
Nishi protested.
So I surmised.
This is awful,
Nishi said.
Has the Legion abandoned me?
Ryle looked at Whitey.
An idea occurs to me.
He returned his attention to Nishi.
Could you part with your soother?
My what?
Ryle pointed at Whitey.
Your soother.
Whitey? What could you want with Whitey?
Ah, yes, you named your soother. I've been told that is customary.
He fell silent, with head cocked to one side. Presently he imaged a note to Nishi. She plucked it from the air as it drifted past her eyes. With a soother's help, I might control this body and not reveal our extraordinary situation, the note read.
Do you understand what he means, Whitey?
Whitey say spy things here.
But what does he mean that he needs you?
Not President sick. Nishi not sick.
Would you go with Ryle?
Nishi say Whitey go Lut Ryle?
Yes.
Whitey go.
I will be sorry to lose you, Whitey.
Whitey friend Nishi. Whitey friend dream. Whitey help sick peoples. Lut President need Whitey. Ryle need Whitey. Nishi looked at the man on the couch and nodded agreement. Ryle stood, and once more Lutt sought control, but a spasm of agony caused him to withdraw immediately. That is a small taste of what you will get if you interfere, Ryle promised. He scooped up the soother and bundled the creature beneath his suit coat.
What of our negotiations?
Nishi asked.
I'll let the French share the secrets of spiral technology.
And Ryle thought, but I will misdirect them. You got that, Lutt? I told you I wouldn't let anyone attack Trina.
Ryle turned toward the door and paused as a musical bell sounded from a vase on a table to his left.
The vase opened along a vertical seam to reveal a vidcom. Nishi crossed to the instrument and pressed the answer key. Major Captain's face appeared on the screen.
There you are, sir, she said, addressing the figure she thought was the president. What is it?
Ryle asked.
We have a first-class snafu on our hands, Mr. President.
She looked pointedly at Nishi.
You may speak in front of Mademoiselle D'Amato, Ryle said. I don't know, sir. This is pretty sensitive. I think you'd better call in the Secret Service with your communications box. This should be scrambled.
Very well. Ryle went to the door and signaled one of the Secret Service men waiting in the hall. Presently, Ryle sat with a scrambler hood over his head. Once more, he looked at Major Captain.
Sir, your brother has gone berserk, she said. He used a pass signed by you to enter the security area where Denny Ra is held, and before anyone could stop him, he killed the dream. Maury? Maury killed Denny Ra?
It's a mess. Yellow blood all over the place. A god-awful stench. Even I threw up, and I'm a doctor.
But how could he do this? What weapon? One of those damn blade guns. An anesthetic poison on it. We don't know whether it was the blades, the poison, or what killed the dream. Some of our experts are coming in for the autopsy, but we may not produce answers. The question now is, what do we do about your brother? Hold him under protective detention. And what do we say if it leaks out?
What makes you think it'll leak out?
Your White House is a sieve, sir. Say my brother struck a blow in the war against the alien menace, but don't release him.
Ryle broke the connection and returned the scrambler to a Secret Service man. Lutt, why did your brother do that? There was no response from his fleshmate.
I insist on an answer, Lut. Do you want more head pain?
Maury's just conducted an experiment, I think. He's learned how to kill a dream.
Why would he want to do that?
He remembers us raving about an alien in our body. Maury plans to assassinate us.
How can he do that if he's a prisoner?
Don't be stupid, Ryle. He uses accomplices. Alarmed, Ryle blurted, "We must go back to the listening post. We've missed something."
There is a perfectly simple explanation for his calling her Nini and her calling him Ryle. Lovers always have pet names. The Prefect's Report. It had been a rough 2 days for Ryle, and he was in no mood for the trip to Dulles Airport, where Phoenicia was to arrive shortly after midnight. No getting out of it, though. He picked up Whitey and girded himself for the ordeal. During the long ride with Aeola to Dulles, he thought about the problems he and Lut confronted. What had they missed at the listening post? It didn't seem possible for Maury to conduct a conspiracy under unwinking scrutiny. Unless you considered everything Maury did suspicious, probably the safest assumption, his actions before killing Denny Ra appeared perfectly normal. The only untoward thing had been a visit to Nishi, but that had been arranged by Woon for a very good reason. Woon remained fearful Subiyama and Nishi would collaborate on more revelations.
"Subiyama's stories are dangerously embarrassing," Woon had stormed. "It must be stopped. If this Tomato Dame won't take money, maybe that Subiyama bitch will."
"Where would you get the money to pay her off?" Ryle had asked.
"How about Hansen Industries? Does your brother have a deep pocket?"
"Deeper than most."
"I'll look into it."
Phoenicia arrived at Dulles later than expected, well past midnight.
"The damn French and their Concords," Lut complained.
Upset by the frustrating search through the listening post, he raged bitterly about the unreliable Concord 9s the French insisted on using to return Phoenicia. An ordinary plane could land at Washington National, but now they gotta show off their damn Concords, and that drags us all the way out to Dulles.
Phoenicia, entering the VIP lounge to be met by the man she thought of as her son, saw him with his new wife, Aeola, and tried to put the best face on this aftermath of what she considered to be her gaffe with Nishi. She rushed up to Aeola, gave her a pecking kiss on the cheek, and turned to do the same for Ryle, but he had stepped back.
"Aeola, how nice," Phoenicia said, and to Ryle, "So good of you to meet me, son."
Ryle patted her arm, more to keep her at a distance than for any pretense of affection. In his best Lut voice, he said,
"Let's hurry it along. We have limousines outside."
Ryle and Aeola had a White House limousine parked at the door of the VIP lounge with Whitey curled up on the back ledge, but at Aeola's suggestion, they had brought the gaudy rickshaw for Phoenicia.
"Your mother always uses it, and it will be a touch of the familiar to welcome her home. Besides, this way, you won't have to ride with her. I know how much you dislike it."
When they emerged from the lounge, Phoenicia took one look at the sprawled robo-coolies in front of the rickshaw and thrust aside her Secret Service escort.
"Take that damned thing away," she shouted, pointing at the rickshaw.
"But, Mother," Ryle said, "I thought you always preferred the rickshaw."
"I rode in it to placate your father. He always insisted I use it. Couldn't you see that?"
Ryle waved for an aide to remove the vehicle. Still in his best Lut voice, trusting excitement and jet lag to dull Phoenicia and prevent her from detecting any personality changes, Ryle said,
"We are sending you to Blair House. I hope you understand. I can't spare you any time just now. And I have Aeola as my hostess."
Phoenicia glared at him.
"You're using her against me, aren't you?"
"Mother, this is my wife, the First Lady."
Aeola clutched Ryle's arm.
"Phoenicia, please. This is family business,"
Phoenicia flared.
"You stay out of it."
"But I am family now,"
Aeola whined. Ryle patted Aeola's hand.
"Be still, dear."
"I knew you'd all turn against me once you won the election," Phoenicia said.
Suddenly realizing this was precisely the spiteful pattern to be expected from Lut, Ryle assumed a sneering grin.
"Think of it as retirement, Mother. You can go back to your parties and your friends."
"You are absolutely hateful.
Where is Maury?"
"Maury is, not here."
I can see that.
He's doing some things with his own patrol. She leaned toward him.
What have you done with your brother?
Nothing at all, Mother.
I want to see Maury immediately. We have company business to discuss.
Those matters have been delegated, Mother.
I am still in charge of the company.
Of course you are, Mother. Do anything you want with Hansen Industries.
You're hiding something from me.
State secrets can be shared only on a limited basis, Mother.
What would Maury have to do with state secrets?
That's a state secret, Ryle said, enjoying the ease with which he fended her questions.
Is it something about that horrible alien? Does this concern all the war talk I hear?
In a way, Mother.
You're even more secretive than your father.
My new duties require it.
She studied him a moment, then... Will the company get any of the weapons contracts?
Only on a bid basis, Mother. I can have nothing to do with it. That would be unethical.
Lot, why are you treating me this way?
What way, Mother? I've just saved your life. The French would have executed you.
Poppycock.
Your head in a basket, Ryle said. I am giving the French what they asked. And you have not thanked me for saving you at great sacrifice.
An aide touched Ryle's arm.
Sir, the Chinese envoy is at 8 a.m. I know, Ryle said. Good night, Mother.
With Aola on his arm, Ryle followed the aide toward the White House limousine. Phoenicia called after them,
Aola, what is he doing? He is being president,
Aola called back. In the limousine, rolling out of the airport with a full cavalcade of guards and aides, Ryle leaned back and closed his eyes. Mercifully, Aola was too tired to resume one of her interminable conversations about their position in society.
You played that pretty well, Ryle,
Lott intruded.
I did, didn't I? You have been most instructive. How about letting me have a little time with Aola tonight? He won't let me have Nini, so what about a roll in the hay with my wife?
You disgust me, Mother.
Want me to fight for control?
Want me to hurt your head?
No. How do you do that? Is it really that cat on the back ledge?
That is not a cat. It is a soother.
I don't find it very soothing.
You're right. Whitey seems to have absorbed strange ways from contact with Earthers.
The way you did?
Before Ryle could compose an answer, the cavalcade of limousines swung through the side gate of the White House, past armed guards standing at attention, and rolled into the rear parking area. A zone patrol officer opened the door for Ryle. As he leaned forward to emerge, Ryle saw more ZPs guarding the dimly lighted rear entrance to the White House.
Glad to see you home safely, sir,
the officer at the limousine door said. Ryle scooped Whitey into a soft bundle and stepped out. No one, not even the officer holding the door, gave any sign they thought it strange to see the president with a cat in his arms.
Son patrolman have many thinks lustful breeding secretary woman, Whitey offered.
This communication leaked through to Lutt.
What about my needs for lustful breeding, Ryle?
Ryle ignored this, but Lutt was not deterred.
Ayola's not all that bad in bed, Ryle. A little prudish, but I find that stimulating.
If I permit it, will you stop interrupting me at crucial moments?
Anything, Ryle. Just watching everything is an awful bore.
Is it? I found it fascinating.
Except for sex.
That, of course.
Maybe you should stay in closer contact while I instruct you in the niceties. It might grow on you.
Stop it this instant, or I shall not grant your request.
Okay, okay, just trying to help.
You are trying to entice me into your disgusting earther pleasures. You think you can control me that way?
You seem to like Basil.
No, Basile. You understand me, Lutt. Basile is over for good.
Anything you say, Ryle.
I mean it.
I see that. Just let me have Aola tonight. She's beginning to wonder why you're not humping her regularly.
Very well. But I shall hurt your head if you try any tricks.
I'll be good.
That is an impossibility for you, Lutt.
Never leave the soother too long in contact with an extremely ill patient.
Soothers not only take on characteristics of their patients, but also are deeply influenced by others with whom they come in mental contact during the therapy period. For this reason, soother applications must occur when there is only one sick mind within their range. Dreen text for advanced education. Once more, Ryle and Lott sat in the listening post to review its data. They had raced the sunset across country using a military plane, the Hump Tulip Sowler, a rocket with wings, the media called it. In the post, Lott dominated because of his more intimate familiarity with the place. They spoke openly, alternating voice control, certain that LH had provided a spy-proof room.
If you're right about a conspiracy to assassinate us, which I will go along with but not concede, the most suspicious events are those visits to Nishi, Ryle said.
You're saying she's in on it?
Ryle managed a superb tone of earther outrage.
Nishi? Never.
Then what are you driving at?
Woon is Moray's logical accomplice. After all, he conspired in your brother's plan to have us murdered on Venus.
That fat boy senator knows what'll happen to him if I'm not around to prevent it.
Perhaps an insufficient deterrent.
What do you mean?
He may believe he could weather a spate of bad publicity if you are the focus of national animus. Make you look bad, and he looks good by comparison.
But he and Moray haven't met. There's only that one VidCom call, and Woon merely asked Moray to go to the Madison with plenty of money.
Which Nishi rejected.
Let's look at the two visits once more, Ryle insisted.
This is the last time.
Lott crunched the listening post controls, and a screen came alive with what was now a boringly familiar sequence. Woon entering Nishi's suite at the Madison.
So he comes in and gives his hat and coat to Ebi, Lott said. Perfectly normal. It's winter, you know.
He's not even carrying a briefcase.
Ryle agreed. So what do they talk about? Just what Woon told me. No more Subiyama revelations. And Nishi says she'll be mum. And Woon says Mori'll be along to recompense Subiyama.
Could Subiyama be the accomplice?
Ryle asked.
Huh? Nuts. That dame reports stories. She doesn't create them. Besides, there's no direct contact with Subiyama.
Could there be more than one accomplice?
Who? We know everything they've said.
Look, Woon leaves and later Mori appears, Lott said.
Roll that one,
Ryle said. Lott obeyed.
Nishi must have talked to Subiyama in the meantime, Lott said. She's already with her answer.
But Mori has a briefcase full of money.
Which she never even opens.
And out Mori goes, Ryle said. He looks happy about something, though.
Mori always enjoys looking at beautiful women.
Nishi gave him no encouragement.
She's suffering symptoms of withdrawal from me.
You've never... never...
But I want another go at my Nini, Ryle. As long as she's still in the capital, why not?
I will not permit it.
Look here, Ryle. We have to be partners. You have your pleasures, and I have mine.
I can read what you're thinking, Lott.
So you know what I want. What's wrong with that?
You will hurt Nishi, and I am determined to protect her.
Christ! You are the world's biggest prude!
Shall we look at more of the post's data?
Ryle asked. What's to see? Woon running campaign headquarters? Mori using his blade gun on that stupid Denny Ra?
Do you now think you were wrong about a conspiracy?
Maybe. But still be cautious. No visits from Mori, not that he'll try. I've never wanted him close, and he knows it. And we keep Woon at a distance.
How long do we hold Mori in Durant's file?
I hope it's vile. And we keep him as long as we can.
The ZP appears amenable, but your mother is becoming importunate.
Let her import all she wants. It's good for her.
I shall resume control now,
Ryle said.
Let us call the Guardians and return to Washington.
You know, Lott said, I like being able to talk like this. With a little practice, we could shift back and forth easily. Might be helpful, because sometimes you're not so good at imitating me.
Good enough to fool your mother.
But what if she gets suspicious?
You may have noticed, Lott, that I am improving with practice.
You like being boss, don't you?
I like the practical application of knowledge.
Well, let's keep this in mind if we need it.
Your new spirit of cooperation is gratifying, Lott.
Would it make you more willing to grant me a few pleasures?
Since I see the pleasures you desire, we will judge each request on its merits.
Whitey stirred in the special pocket and blasted forth a thought that filled the minds of both Ryle and Lutt.
Pleasure make cure sick man's.
Ryle was a moment recovering from the force of the projection. When he gathered his wits, he protested.
Whitey, you promised Nishi you would help me.
Who are you?
I'm Ryle, the Dreen.
A long pause, then.
Ryle, Lutt, mix. Cure Ryle, cure Lutt.
I don't need curing. You're supposed to help me control Lutt, otherwise he will attack Dreener.
Lutt not hurt Dreens.
Whitey hurt him's head. Yes, Whitey, that's what you're supposed to do.
Whitey hurt many head, they not make a nice thought.
Again, the force of Whitey's thought stunned Ryle. Lutt took over their voice and spoke weakly.
What the hell's happened?
It's Whitey,
Ryle whispered.
I don't know what's wrong with him.
Whitey not sick. Lutt sick. Ryle sick. Whitey fix.
Please, Whitey,
Ryle pleaded.
I can't think when you do that.
You, Ryle? You go big White House now. You call Nishi. You tell Nishi see you.
Whitey, we can't do...
Ryle broke off, clutching his head in a flash of agony.
Whitey say you go Nishi now.
The tests of War Traveler 2 exceeded expectations. Orbited Venus in 18 seconds. To Mars in another 27 seconds. Returned in 22 seconds. Total elapsed time, 1 minute and 7 seconds. Sam R. Cann's report.
A terrible task falls on you, jongleur, Habiba said, glaring down at him from a night-lighted platform in her mud-brick home. He had sped through the dark in response to Habiba's call, and had no idea of the exact time, but it was late, or early. Sleep had evaded him for days, and a presentiment of what the supreme tax collector was about to say flattened his brow. She looked terrible there, jongleur thought. Deep, dark shadows under her eyes, smooth areas beside her horn-tool nose. He had never before seen smoothing of Habiba's skin. Jongleur trembled. All four knees ached. Why was she standing on that platform?
The Erasure ship must be sent, Habiba said. It is fate, I believe.
Jongleur gaped. Fate? Dreens do not think in such terms. Creation, cause and effect, yes. Fate, never.
But why have you summoned me?
He quavered.
You must erase Earth, Habiba intoned. I can entrust this terrible responsibility to no other.
For a moment, Jongleur thought he would faint.
Habiba,
he croaked.
Please.
The task is yours, Jongleur, she said. You are my chief storyteller.
Her words filled him with painful pride.
Habiba's chief storyteller. But the consequences.
Could we not wait for Mowgli's return?
He pleaded.
This whole thing was his idea.
I fear Mowgli will not return, she said.
Shock upon shock.
Mowgli? Not returning? What perilous task had Habiba given him?
Are you sure? Habiba.
I am sure.
But Mowgli's helpers are still... there's Luhan. He could...
Luhan? This is no time for jests.
I was not...
That's worse. I give you a direct order. Take the ship to Earth and erase that hideous place. At once. If you leave now, I have calculated it will be over within 40 hours.
Habiba... You predicted catastrophe if we...
At once, jongleur.
Will I, too, not return?
You may survive, but it is unlikely you will return.
Her tone softened.
It saddens me for us to part this way.
She would not be swayed. He saw this.
May I have time for a few last words with my family?
He pleaded.
That would only spread sadness and fear,
Go to the ship. Do what must be done.
And Ryle, my son, on Earth?
You're stalling, jongleur. Earth must go. The fate of everyone in that dreadful creation is sealed. That word again. Fate. Habiba pointed to the door. Go! 40 hours from now, there must be no Earth. Trembling and faltering, Jongleur departed. He felt that he shed his past as some creatures shed their skins. But a heavier load replaced his past. Who would have thought a future could have such weight? The eternal now he once had enjoyed, erased. Future and past became alien. Outside, Jongleur threaded his way through bands of the elite huddled in the control cone's dim night lights, fearing to enter Habiba's presence without a summons. They called to him, "Jongleur, what of Habiba? Why are you downcast?" He could only shake his head. But now he realized why Habiba had looked down at him from an elevation.
"She could not bring herself to look me straight in the eyes."
"Something is wrong," one of the elite shouted. "You must tell us what is happening."
Sadness and fear.
His very presence spread that awful mixture.
"And I am powerless to do anything but obey Habiba. I am her chief storyteller. And this is the consequence."
"Great danger exists in the constant certainty that you have always made proper decisions." Greco-Drean aphorism. Ryle felt like a conspirator as he slipped into the tradesman's door of the Madison, where an advance party of the Secret Service detained a service elevator. Up they went to Nishi's floor, guards around him grinning. Some had seen Nishi. Word of her beauty and background on Venus had spread. They knew why he came here with such secrecy. But Nishi herself had asked him to make an immediate visit, and her message did not explain the reason. The squirming presence of Whitey in his suit coat pocket dictated that he obey the summons.
"You not go, Nishi. Whitey hurt head."
Ryle had experienced enough of Whitey's enforcement to know he could not resist the soother. Nishi greeted him in a parlor. The bedroom door behind her opened to reveal street clothes thrown over a chair. She wore a thin nightgown under a blue housecoat. Matching pom-pom slippers covered her feet.
"Is it Ryle or Lot?"
she greeted him. "Ryle," he said. "What do you—"
"I am doing this for Mrs. Eby. Lot's father treated her shamelessly. You must correct this."
"Yes, but Whitey is—"
"Ryle, not talk Whitey. Talk love cure."
Ryle almost sagged with the force of the projection. Nishi blushed.
"Whitey is talking to me,"
she whispered.
"It wants me to. I can't."
"You go, Nishi, bed," Whitey ordered.
Ryle shuddered, and as Whitey gave him a taste of enforcement, grabbed his head.
"Please, no, no, Whitey, no."
"Hey," Lot intruded. "If you don't want, I will." Whitey's response was immediate. A surge of agony shot up their spine.
"Ryle, what is it?"
Nishi asked, seeing him stagger.
"Hurting. I had—" "Mother of God!"
Nishi put her hands over her mouth. "You go, Nishi, bed," Whitey repeated, and emphasized the order with a brief shot of pain. Ryle fell against Nishi. She held him with surprising strength.
"Oh, Ryle, I'm sorry."
"What am I to do?"
Ryle moaned. "That's a stupid question," Lot offered. "Do it, and I want to participate." Ryle tried to pull away from Nishi, but she held him even more tightly.
"No,"
he whispered.
"At least let me share," Lot insisted.
"No.
You're nothing but a damn spoil sport."
"But Whitey asks, it is not sport."
Lot was amused.
"Sure it is."
Nishi put her lips close to Ryle's ear and stroked his head.
"Do you still hurt?"
"Not,
Not much. She put an arm around him, and supporting his faltering steps, steered him toward the bedroom.
Where are we going?
Ryle whispered. Nishi spoke with candid practicality.
I cannot remain a virgin forever.
Oh, Nishi, no.
You not do Nishi love cure Whitey hurt head bad.
I got that,
Nishi said. They reached the bedroom, flouncy empire decor with a green canopied bed. Nishi eased Ryle backward until he tumbled across a soft comforter. She began removing her clothes.
It's all right,
she said, as he once more tried to protest.
I've sent Mrs. Eby away for the night. We are alone.
Ryle tried to straighten.
What are you doing?
That's a foolish question, she said. I will not make love to you through wads of messed up clothing.
Nishi, I can stand the pain. You don't have to do...
Whitey make head hurt bad. Ryle feel hurt. Ryle screamed in agony.
For Christ's sakes, do what Whitey wants,
Lot argued. Dropping the last of her clothes, Nishi rolled him over, slipped off his suit coat and shirt, removed his shoes, then his trousers and shorts. She stepped back, and he had his first full look at an unclothed female earther. It was oddly stimulating. Before climbing onto the bed, she turned down the lights. Ryle closed his eyes and felt her nibble his right ear.
You do nothing, Nishi said. I know how, from watching experts.
Whitey, help!
Both Ryle and Nishi received the words. Immediately, Ryle became intimately aware of intense physical reactions. They surprised him.
You see, Nishi whispered, you too know what to do.
Ryle began to lose control of himself in the deepest pleasure sensations he had ever experienced.
Oh, blessed Habiba,
he whispered.
Why didn't anyone warn me?
He could feel Whitey insinuated into every intimate fleshly contact, amplifying nerve responses and sharing the experience. As pleasure climbed to ecstasy, their attention concentrated so intently that not even Whitey noted the return of Mrs. Eby. She hesitated in the doorway.
Just what she had expected. That monster forcing himself on poor Nishi.
Well, a few minutes' work and I'll really be rich, and Nishi will be free of the Hansons forever.
Adult males. Captives, 59. Basil addicts, 53. Adult females. Captives, 46. Basil addicts, 37. Male children. Captives, 0. Basil addicts, 0. Female children. Captives, 0. Basil addicts, 0. Totals. Captives, 105. Basil addicts, 90.
Drains in captivity. A zone patrol report.
A strong southwest wind, spreading rain across southern Florida, drenched the mangrove swamp behind Osceola's hideaway shack for most of the day. She and Dude were kept busy for a time, creating barriers to close gaping cracks in the windward walls. By dusk, the rain stopped and the wind eased, though it recurred in occasional gusts that rattled loose boards. Raj Dude, resting naked on Osceola's bed after his labors, watched her at work in a corner of the room, preparing a freshly caught pompano for baking in the hot ashes of a fire pit sheltered under the shack's eaves. She wore a brilliant orange dress with tie-dyed splotches of purple like squashed insects.
You know, Ossie, he said, it sure takes a lot out of you to create even little things like those wind deflectors. I wonder how dreams do so much of it and don't collapse.
They're probably bred for it,
she said, tying leaves around the fish and hefting the bundle.
About 6 pounds. Gonna be hungry by the time this is ready to eat.
How can Dreens be so much better at it than we are, and yet so limited? He asked.
Said it yourself, idiot savants. Don't know about other dimensions. Just concentrate on what they have. Probably answers your other question. Limit themselves to what they know.
She went outside with the fish. When she returned, she found him sitting up on the bed, eyes open and with the glassy look of creative concentration.
Thought you were wore out, she muttered, reclining beside him on the bed. He did not respond. Osceola sighed. Sometimes she wished her lover had never made his weird discoveries. Then again, she would not have developed spirit glass, nor ways of scooting around the universe. She liked seeing new places, but the boredom of long trips took the fun out of it. This way, they had the best of everything. Dude could play his games on Venus and spend his spare time here, and she could go where she wished, within reason.
Wonder what the old fool's making now.
She stared at him, squinting to tune in on what he was doing. The expected creative surge did not occur. He radiated a random smear of thoughts.
What the devil's he doing?
She began to worry. It was not like Dude to take this long at his creative labors. She shook his shoulder.
Slowly, a somnambulist waking, he began to focus his eyes.
He turned a frown toward Osceola.
Sure hope I did the right thing, he muttered.
What were you doing? Making an illusion. Everything's illusion, you old fool. Ah, see, the Dreens are sending a ship to wipe out Earth.
She snapped upright.
Wipe us out? What do you mean?
They'll erase us just as though we'd never been. Everything associated with us will vanish.
We gotta do something.
Did. Just hope it's enough. What have you done?
I've set a sort of dimensional tripwire to flip their ship out of the spirals in between directly over an illusory Earth.
What do you mean, illusory?
It looks like Earth, but it doesn't really exist, except as a projection from another dimension.
What's that supposed to do?
Dreams are peculiar animals, Arcee. Ones we've studied all have that blind spot. Act like they don't know about other dimensions. But they must come from another dimension.
What good's it do us knowing that?
They're compulsive pacifists, until something they've created threatens them. And that's us.
We ain't threatening them.
I'm afraid we are. Humans find it hard to share space with other animals. We've got this them-or-us nature. If we can't cage or control it some way, we want to kill it. Dreens know that. Hell, Arcee, they made this world.
That's what you keep saying, but I...
It's true, Arcee.
What's that have to do with this ship, you say, is...
That's it, don't you see? To stop us, they have to go against a basic instinct and eliminate something they've made. Violence.
So what happens when they blow up your illusion? I'm not sure, but this gives us time to think about a more permanent solution. As long as they don't latch on to other dimensions, I can keep faking them out. How do you know?
That Habiba talks to herself a lot, and she keeps a journal and a diary.
You've been spying on them, you old fool. I thought we agreed that was dangerous. They're kind of distracted right now, I see. Not as alert as they were.
You went there? No, just sort of looked through the keyhole like we did when we stumbled onto them. Damnedest thing. They've got this kind of crude illusion built up around Dreener, a false Dreener, to make the place look uninhabitable. That's what gave me the idea, how to divert them.
Just that one look was enough for me, she said. They give me the creepy willies.
Dreener sure is one strange place. Not rightly a planet. Got roots into infinity. They call that ampleness. Thinking about infinity seems to give them a pain.
Gives me a pain, too.
But you're mortal, and know it. They've always thought they were sort of immortal, except for accidents.
This one of your little jokes, dude.
I swear, Arcee, I had this bad presentiment and went looking for the cause. You know how I am.
Yeah, you'd stick your nose in a cotton gin if you thought there was something worth seeing there. You sure your illusion will stop the Dreens?
I keep strangers out of our swamp, don't I?
But Dreens ain't human.
They still believe in what they see. No different from a hunter thinking he sees a swamp full of rampaging boar gators
or believing he stumbled into a zillion cottonmouths.
But if you're wrong, we'll have a worse problem than explaining to some stranger how we come to live away out here.
Trust me, I see. Dreens may be better at making some things than I am, but they've no understanding at all about how to set up a con game from another dimension.
Sometimes you make my skin crawl, dude.
I tell you what, Ossie, while we're waiting for that fish to cook, why don't we get into some heavy skin crawling? Here, let me help you out of that dress.
Life is full of decisions, and there is no absolutely safe course. Reason and logic often create only the illusion of safety. Arthur Aphorism, A Dream Collection. Having seen what she expected, that awful Hansen monster having his way with poor Nishi, Mrs. Eby lifted the blade gun she had purchased in obedience to the note crumpled in Senator Woon's hat. As the note had said, a mind-stunning amount of money was passed to her later in Maury's hat with a promise of even greater riches, if she did as she was told. She lifted the weapon, twisted the handle as instructed, aimed it, and depressed the trigger. The blade gun performed exactly according to its accompanying manual, only a soft slap as the poisoned anesthetic dart struck its target. Ryle, still gripped by the highest pleasure sensation of his life, felt a brief sting and clutched his buttock.
"Darling Ryle,"
Nishi whispered,
"was it good for you too?"
"Something stung me," Ryle said. His groping hand felt wetness. A hard object protruded from his flesh. A numbing sensation spread outward from his buttock. His dream senses reported poison. Whitey, coming out of intimate concentration, became aware of Mrs. Eby and, too late, read her thoughts.
"Bad Lady Eby make poison thing in Ryle."
Ryle felt the soother go completely out of mental contact. Lot intruded.
"What's happening? Something's wrong. Why won't you let me feel anything?"
Ryle blocked him off and concentrated on stopping the slide into unconsciousness. He rolled off of Nishi, who murmured sleepily,
"Only you, Ryle. Never Lot."
"Whitey?"
Ryle called. But the thought was weak and he felt no response. What was happening to the soother? Had it been killed? Whitey came back slowly from reflexive withdrawal. Nothing in the soother's nature allowed for regrets that the dullness of Mrs. Eby's mind had led to avoidance of mental contact with her. No recriminations about the fact that the assassination plot had been conducted only with notes and gestures entered the soother's awareness. But millennia of breeding for benign therapeutic support of dreams exploded in Whitey. The soother went berserk. Mrs. Eby dropped her blade gun and screamed. She clutched her head and staggered around the bedroom. "Bad Lady Eby hurt Dreen. Whitey hurt Bad Lady." Mrs. Eby collapsed into a moaning ball. The moaning grew fainter. Her breathing faltered and stopped. With his last consciousness, Ryle sent a call.
"Whitey!"
Immediately, Ryle felt his consciousness reinforced. Lut intruded.
"We're dying. I know we are. Do something."
Ryle responded to the panic.
"Whitey, Lut's weakening me. Block him off."
A wall went up in Ryle's awareness, silencing Lut. Then, "What, Ryle, want?"
"I'm dying. There's a way to save me, but I missed it in school. Do you know the way?"
"Whitey, help Trine." Ryle felt probing tendrils on his mind, a twinge here, a prod there. He felt himself reliving school experiences with a more mature awareness. The path to survival unfolded. Memories came into focus. At last, he had his answer. "The way in is the way out."
"But I need a new body."
Transformation required almost the full power of a story ship, and he had to kill or accept flesh already dead. "Bad Lady Eby dead," Whitey offered. Dismay threatened to sink him into oblivion. Where could he find a story ship? "Story ship come," Whitey insisted. "Here." Ryle felt himself stretched along a thin thread from Nishi's bed, coiling outward to the perimeter of the solar system. Like a magnet, the thread's outer tip locked onto an approaching story ship, and he recognized the captain.
"Father!"
No time even to wonder if the elder Dreen recognized his son's thready presence. Survival required concentration. Ryle allowed his thread self to tap the story ship's power and felt infinitely strengthened, possessed of unlimited time. His thread self wound around Mrs. Eby's body. What shape should he take? Without knowing why he supplied the data, Ryle realized Nishi admired dark Irish types with tightly curled black hair. Holding fast to his thread self, Ryle almost drained story ship power to feed a voracious imaging effort. Mrs. Eby melted into oblivion, her cellular memories erased by Whitey in the interest of Dreen sanity. A handsome Earther male took form on the floor of Nishi's bedroom. Except for Dreen eyes, the face echoed Legion Captain O'Hara, but with stronger cheeks and chin. As he felt his new body take shape, Ryle experienced a surge of reckless elation. Now he knew what had driven Lut to risk his life in desperate gambles. What a marvelous sensation of life! So this was what it meant to be alive. Jongleur on the Erasure ship looked on what he thought was Earth and saw his instruments register a dangerous energy train. Earthers are fighting me. Using emergency power, he flipped through the 8 stages of Erasure and depressed the final trigger without once thinking about consequences. Raj Dude's illusory planet vanished. Jongleur fell to the deck in shock.
I have killed. I have committed mass murder in the name of all Dreens.
His highly charged thought shot outward to be received by all but 2 of the Dreens in his universe. Ryle, in the throes of transformation and tied to survival necessities, caught none of his father's message. Prusik, at home in Texas and in the deepest Bazile ecstasy of his life, having drunk almost 1 liter of basil extract, remained a comatose copy of Ludoti. Subiyama, beside him in bed, stroked his forehead and wondered about that new liquor he was making. But all Dreens captive on Earth and the massed throngs of Dreener received Jongleur's signal. Instant amnesiacs, they responded to the ancient summons and fled to other dimensions, scattering like dandelion seeds blown on the wind. It is done, Habiba thought, and joined the exodus. In Nishi's bedroom, Ryle completed his shapeshift and decided to gather his strength before Idmijin clothes. He flexed his new muscles and sat up. This body contained less mass than his old one, but Whitey soothed him. Ryle's safe. What of Lut? Ryle wondered. Whitey saved Dreen. Lut Earther dead. Ryle stood and looked down at the sleeping Nishi. Whitey was a curled ball of fur near her neck. A male form lay beside her, unbreathing. Ryle studied the familiar shape he had shared for what seemed eons. A pang of regret flashed through him.
Such a waste.
The lost potential of this Earther life filled Ryle with frustration. If the creature had only tried to learn. A soft rapping sounded on the bedroom door.
Mr. President?
Ryle recognized the voice of a Secret Service guard. With abrupt dismay, Ryle realized he stood naked in a bedroom with an assassination victim those Secret Service men would identify as the President of the United States. Stalling for time, he pitched his voice in the remembered Lut tones.
What is it?
The White House is calling, sir. There's a crisis call from the ZP. Something about Dreen prisoners escaping. Fellow Dreens escaping? Ryle grinned with elation. But how should Lut respond?
Shit.
Sir, they're insisting, the Secret Service man said. Tell them to keep their pants on. I'll be with you as fast as I can. Nishi, awakened by voices, sat up and focused on Ryle's new body. She put a hand over her mouth.
Who are...
It's Ryle, he whispered. She looked at the body beside her, back to the new Ryle. He bent close to her and whispered,
Mrs. Eby killed him. I had to make a new body.
She lowered her hand.
Mrs. Eby?
She looked around the room. There was no sign of Mrs. Eby.
Whitey killed her, Ryle whispered.
Whitey, help.
Nishi cocked her head to one side, then straightened.
Whitey says you made the body I would like.
She looked him up and down.
Very handsome. I didn't know you could do that.
She looked at the door.
What now?
The practicality of the question told Ryle she accepted the situation without more argument. Cross-examination would come later, he realized, provided there was a later. Ryle stared at the door, visualizing the impatience out there. What should he do? If he tried a new copy of Lut, the smaller size would be seen immediately, unless... No, he would not make another merging with that remembered flesh. Some of Lut might remain in the cells. One experience of Lut Hansen Jr. was enough. Remove the evidence of assassination? It would require time to cleanse that body of all poison, and even then, clever investigators would suspect foul play. He and Nishi would be required to explain the unexplainable. No, that was too risky. Something clicked in the lock of the bedroom door. It opened a crack. A Secret Service man peered in at him. Seeing a stranger in the room, the guard threw the door open wide. Who are you? He saw the familiar figure of his president on the bed, a very quiet figure not responding to this intrusion. The guard's hand darted into his jacket and emerged with a deadly stunner. Whitey, reading new danger to a precious Dreen,
attacked. The Secret Service man dropped his weapon, clutched his head, and fell to the floor. He was dead before Ryle could reach him. Ryle took only a moment to make sure the soother had killed for a second time, so the soother learned quick violence.
Whitey, you must not kill people.
Not let bad people's hurt Dreen. Ryle stood.
Get dressed, Nishi. We have to run.
She glanced at the door, eyebrows raised.
Whitey, please. Just hurt their heads a little,
Ryle pleaded. The soother did not respond. Hoping the order would be obeyed, Ryle said,
Whitey will help us.
She accepted this and began dressing, taking the clothes she had left over a chair. Ryle imaged a tweed suit with black shoes, white shirt, and a dark gray tie. He looked at himself in a bedroom mirror, seeing Nishi behind him already dressed.
Mad in the fen,
she said, looking at the body on the bed.
Hey, what's taking so...
Another Secret Service man stood in the bedroom doorway. He saw his fellow guard on the floor, the still figure on the bed, Nishi and Ryle in street clothes. The man's hand flashed toward a shoulder holster, but did not complete the motion. He fell with a solid whack.
Nishi, Ryle, take Whitey, go now.
The projection from Whitey stunned them.
Take Whitey, go!
Whitey emphasized the order with a short jab of pain. Knowing he could not resist, Ryle grabbed up the aberrant soother, and Nishi in tow plunged toward the door. Screams of agony greeted them in the hallway. Guards lay writhing on the floor, hands clutching their heads.
Where are we going?
Nishi demanded as Ryle, leaping over and dodging the incapacitated guardians, led her at a run toward the elevators.
We will find an airplane, Ryle said. We must get to France where the Legion will protect you.
The streets outside the Madison presented a larger repeat of the pandemonium in the upper hall. People lay on the sidewalk and street, some quiet, some screaming. Ryle assessed the scene. Stalled cars straddled the curbs. Other cars sat smashed against buildings, dropping coolants and oils while their occupants moaned or sat silently immobile.
Please, Whitey, hurt them just a little. Nishi, Ryle, not talk hurt. Nishi, Ryle, run.
They could do nothing but obey the soother. Around a corner from the Madison, they found a car, its driver drooling out the open door, his eyes glazed in pain. With Nishi's help, Ryle eased the man onto the sidewalk and appropriated his car. As they sped toward the National Airport, cars ahead of them swerved aside, clearing a path. The extent of Whitey's power over Earthers astonished Ryle, who urged moderation, but the soother would not respond until they were in the terminal.
Go big flying thing, gate 6.
Nishi saw the gate sign and led the way. They found an Air France Boeing Rocketeer at gate 6, prepared for final boarding, but everyone in the plane, including crew, unconscious. Ryle stared at the interior of the plane in outrage.
Now what, Whitey?
Ryle not make flying thing go?
How am I supposed to do that?
Ryle know how, Lot fly plane thing.
This is no war traveler.
Whitey help. And Whitey proceeded to fill his mind with knowledge appropriated from the unconscious crew. Saying a silent prayer to Habiba, Ryle closed the plane's doors, cleared the cockpit of its unconscious crew, and made sure the dormant people were strapped into seats. Taking his place in the pilot's seat, he looked at the instruments and controls. Nishi slipped into the co-pilot's position.
Ryle, Nishi, do what Whitey say.
What else can we do, Whitey?
The irony of the question was lost on the soother, who concentrated on getting them to safety.
We go, France Legion, make happy love cure place.
As the plane lifted from the ground, Ryle felt himself blushing, but he dared hope Whitey's promise would be kept.
The extraordinary phenomena occurring around President Hansen's assassination have been traced to an alien attack on Earth. The combined military forces of our planet are repelling this infamous and underhanded viciousness. No matter how long it takes, we will overcome.
Acting U.S. President, Jehoon Clanton.
Look at this, Ursie.
Raj Dude pointed to a display and a news receiver set up in the shade of a thatched sunscreen at the end of their rickety pier. The inlet and nearby hideaway shack baked in noon glare. The shiny receiver looked out of place in the primitive setting. Osceola, in a pink and green muumuu, was pole fishing from the end of the pier. She concentrated on a red float bobbing suggestively in the sparkling water.
Not now, she said. Think I got a bite.
But this is interesting. They say fashion news was made today by Nishi D'Amato, the hottest couturier in Paris, when she unveiled her new Venus Flame line.
Calls herself D'Amato in her profession, he added. But privately, she's Mrs. Ryle. That was the Dreen's name, remember?
So that's what she did after she offed your nephew.
Osceola jerked the tip of her pole skyward, but brought off a bare hook.
Damn, got my bait.
How many times do I have to tell you it was that damn soother killed him?
And you couldn't save him?
Raj Dude shook his head sadly.
I don't think anyone could have saved him after what old L.H. did to him.
So the soother killed him. But who told it to kill?
Nobody needed to tell it. What else could it learn there in Washington? Osceola spoke while rebaiting her hook.
You should have studied that critter more before you threw it away.
Hell and damnation, you are the most contrary female I ever met. I had to send it into another dimension fast as I could. The thing was wild crazy.
She reset the line below her bobber and lowered it gently into the water.
So we still got two Dreens on Earth. That one married to this D'Amato and the one they call the Basil King of Texas. Should you do anything about them?
They're harmless, I tell you.
But Dreens can get soothers and soothers can kill.
Only if they're shown the example. Soothers are sensitive to any madness around them. Can't cure more than one person at a time, so when they can't function, they go nuts.
Yeah, well, I was you. I wouldn't allow any more of those things on Earth. And I'd keep an eye on our two Dreens, especially old Basil King. He may be the biggest grower-shipper of that stuff, but he gets high on it, too. No telling what he might do when he's high.
Raj Dude abruptly leaned closer to the story unfolding on his display.
Galloping gurus, he muttered. Know what those Dreens are planning next?
You're talking so much you're scaring the fish, Osceola complained. I'm trying to catch our dinner.
He ignored her.
It says here these old friends, the Subiyamas and the Ryals, are planning a daring hang glider vacation in the Himalayas.
Osceola set her pole in a wire holder and joined him under the sunshade. She looked at the display over his shoulder.
Damn it all! I told you those Dreens were dangerous, she said. If we're right about them, anything happens to those last two, this whole Earth and everything about it vanishes in a puff of smoke.
Raj Dude turned off his receiver.
We'd better get some warm clothing, he said. Looks like we're going to spend our vacation in the Himalayas this year.
Hey! He pointed at the fishbowl, which was bobbing violently in its hanger.
You got something!
I got a pain in the ass for a lover, she said.
But I guess you're the best available.
She strolled into the sunlight, lifted her pole, and admired the way it arched and jerked under the weight of a heavy fish.
But when you got 'em hooked, you got 'em.
End of Man of Two Worlds by Frank Herbert and Brian Herbert. Narrated by Roy Avers in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky. For the Library of Congress, January 1987. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, G.P. Putnam's Sons, 200 Madison Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container straps or latches before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container, braille side down, for identification.